Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars, artists, and librarians about research and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. Today, I'm very delighted to have on the show Hester Blum, professor of English at Pennsylvania State University. Professor Blum is an Americanist and has authored the monograph, The View from the Masthead, Maritime Imagination and Antebellum American Sea Narratives, and numerous journal articles. She is the editor of William Ray's captivity narrative, Horrors of Slavery or the American Tars in Tripoli, and has also edited and co-edited collections of essays in American studies. She is the founder of C19, the Society of 19th Century Americanists, and is a past president of the Melville Society. And she's with us today to talk about her most recent book, The News at the Ends of the Earth, The Print Culture of Polar Exploration, published by Duke University Press in 2019. Welcome, Hester.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's wonderful to have you here. I love the book. Not all academic books are really a fun read, but I really ripped through this one. I couldn't put it down. You mentioned in the foreword to the book that the idea for it began in part with your having seen an exhibition of polar exploration materials at the Grolier Club. Materials to some extent collected, I think, by a friend of mine, a fellow art librarian, Deidre Stamm and her husband.
Yes, David and Deidre Stamm have been remarkably wonderful and generous friends and mentors subsequently. But at the time, I had not met them yet. I did not know of their work. And a friend in the museum trade had passed along notice of their Grolier Club exhibit, which was called Books on Ice, knowing that I was interested in sailors' literary culture. And so I went to the exhibition and had one of those eureka moments that is something that I think popular culture likes to think that academics come to when they have ideas that strike them. But that is not usually the way my own process works. But I had a total light bulb eureka moment when I saw a copy in the exhibition of the Illustrated Arctic News, the first newspaper printed in the Arctic. And I had no idea such things existed because sailors write and read a ton while they're at sea, but they almost never create newspapers. It's really rare for sailors, for working sailors to do so. And so I had a moment where I thought, this is the next book project I want to work on. What is this thing? Why does it exist? How did it come to be here?
That's great, because when librarians put these exhibits on, we always think, well, maybe someone will see it and we'll give them an idea. But rarely do you get this kind of feedback where you see it actually happen. So,
No, I was at the exhibit with my husband, who's also a scholar, and I turned to him and said, this is my next book. And I didn't.
And that's wonderful.
And lo, it came to pass.
So, you know, when we think of American literature, we often think of the sea with nautical fiction, like, you know, the works, of course, of Melville and even Poe and others as shining examples, a bit like the genre of maritime art in the world of painting. There is a whole genre in literature of nautical fiction. So I wonder, is there something about reading or possibly writing even and seafaring that go together? I remember just briefly thinking when I was a child and reading Jack London's sea stories that it must have been nice for him to decide to become a hand on a merchant ship so he would have time to write. And I think perhaps he was thinking the same thing. He probably didn't have as much time as he thought he was going to have to write, but he did write. So is there something about seafaring and writing that are highly compatible particularly?
I mean, that's been my observation. And I think part of that is the fact that for sailors, unlike most working people, the job site and the off-job site, the home site, become the same thing for a long stretch of time. For sailors on long voyages, you don't, at the end of the day, at the end of your shift, you can't leave the ship and go home. You're still there. And so sailors have to occupy themselves in leisure practice, but that leisure is always happening at the same place as their job site. And so I think that having work and the work of sail and the actual process of moving through the world and moving this machine through the world, the machine of the ship, is something that inspires a kind of imaginative reflection that is also tied, of course, to the natural scene before them, which can be blank seeming, can be wild, can be hostile. But because you're always on the job site, the sailor life and sailor thinking go together with sailor work.
That's interesting. I suppose also because you're sailing and you are moving, there's an allegorical element in a way, in that you're always reliving the Odyssey in a way. I mean, it's necessarily exploring, even if you're just going from place to place with a merchant ship, isn't it?
Certainly. And the presumption is that sailing stories end with a homeward return in that Odyssean way, which is, of course, not the case with the books that you mentioned, like Poe and Melville. They're recognizing that not all sailing stories end at home.
Really interesting. I know much of the culture you are researching here in this book is transmitted through ephemeral documents. They're printed documents often, but they're ephemeral also, not necessarily meant to be kept for posterity once they're produced. And I wonder if you have any stories about where you found your materials and what institutions you've worked in to conduct your research. I mean, was it difficult finding materials once you decided to do this? I suppose it's a question.
Well, I certainly didn't know at that first moment in the Grolier Club where the materials would be, whether they were collected. I had very little sense of that archive, even though I had worked in lots of maritime libraries before, from Mystic Seaport's Blunt White Library, which is excellent, and the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich in England, also superb. But I didn't know with the polar ephemeral where those materials would be. And I didn't realize at the start how long it would take to do the traveling that I ended up doing. In the course of the 10 years I spent working on that book, I went to over 30 different archives and libraries in 5 or 6 countries with a lot of help and support from funding from those libraries and archives, as well as from Penn State, my home institution. So it was the kind of project that would not have been possible if I'd had more constrained timeline. This is very much a second book in the sense that I didn't have that short 6-year window to get this project done on those terms, as well as having the privilege of having the institutional access for the time and money to travel to see these books. So it really is a project that is indebted to that kind of attention to and support of that kind of research. But the repositories came from a range of places. In the US, Dartmouth College has a marvelous Arctic collection called the Stephenson Collection, which is probably the best source of polar materials in the US. Mm-hmm. In the UK, the Scott Polar Research Institute has an enormous amount of material related to British Arctic and Antarctic exploration. But I also was making all kinds of trips to archives that had no particular interest in polar collecting, but might have the papers of a surgeon who spent time on an Arctic voyage. And in the ephemeral or miscellaneous folder of that surgeon's collection would be some polar printing. So it was a really long process of tracing out not just where papers from individual sailors had ended up, but whether or not the sometimes uncataloged or at least not easily searchable miscellaneous and ephemeral folders, what they contained, which could be something amazing and incredible, like a tooth with a menu from a particular polar meal, or could contain nothing of particular interest.
Yeah, really interesting. So some material is ephemeral, like these newspapers are ephemeral, but some is meant to be kept, of course, like ship's logs, of course, which would go into maritime collections. Navies keep records for sure of the happenings and also engagements of their ships. And these expeditions are also collecting scientific data, right? Which is very interesting because oftentimes, and it ties into our world now, climate data, going way back into the 19th century from the first voyages. Isn't that the case?
Yes, these sailing projects, polar ships, as well as sailing vessels in general, produce so much paperwork. They're constantly documenting the ship's movements, the weather, the wind speed, the air temperature, the water temperature. And polar expeditions were really particularly focused on things like magnetism as well as the temperature controls. Because again, for many of the European, Northern European and North American sailors to these regions did not have a lot of experience with the far north and eventually the far south. And so that kind of normal nautical record keeping was somewhat on overdrive. They were making multiple copies of their locations. The record keeping was really voluminous. And the survival of that data has been used to track climate change today. And it's been really central to those kinds of inquiries. And it's also especially helpful in realizing that the height of Arctic expeditionary energies from Britain in particular comes at the same time that theories of planetary ice ages were being developed. In some part, that's coincidence, but the kind of theories of people like Charles Lyell and Louis Agassiz about the planetary ice ages are in the scientific news at the same time these Arctic expeditions are taking their own weather and ice data.
We just assume this is going to be the case when we go to the moon, don't we? That we're going to collect all kinds of data and learn about the moon, but you don't think of it in terms of the Earth so much. Although I suppose when I think back to watching Star Trek, the first thing you hear from Captain Kirk when the episode starts is, you know, Stardate, whatever, ship's log, you know, he's logging us so well.
It's an incredibly regulated process. Uh-huh. And these polar expeditions brought multiple copies of blank forms that they used to use to record latitude and longitude location that would be left in bottles thrown overboard or in cairn messages, recognizing that these are ships that were not going to be pulling into ports with the same kind of frequency as other ships might. They're just kind of scattering records as widely as possible.
Oh, that is amazing. So it is ephemeral in that way, and that, you know, a message in a bottle for sure.
No, for sure. Exactly.
Yeah. So you were recently in the Antarctic on an expedition yourself?
Yes, this was an amazing opportunity to join some Penn State alumni and other university alumni on a trip through Albatross expeditions that sailed from Ushuaia in Argentina through the Drake Passage, the stormiest water in the world, which we were told that we had an exceptionally calm passage. They call it the Drake Lake, although most of us were still bouncing into walls every step. But we spent time on the Antarctic Peninsula and just had a marvelous experience, not only with penguins and whales and all manner of seabirds and seals, but we also had the opportunity of seeing a cairn left by an Antarctic expedition from 100 years ago, a cairn that was dedicated to a pig named Toby that the Charcot expedition decided to keep as a friend rather than eating him.
Oh, good for Toby. It's nice they left that kind of record. We'll get into the cairns after a bit because it is there. Sure. It's a very strange idea, not leaving messages in bottles, but leaving them under rocks in the middle of nowhere where people only may come across them every couple of 100 years. So for what purpose? You know, when you told me you were down there, I was reading at the same time about the exploration for Shackleton's Endurance that was going on. And I'm thinking, wow, is Hester with that crew? But you weren't. But they did find a ship a week or two ago only, didn't they? And to big hoopla, front page of the New York Times, I'm sure front page of the London Times.
It was extraordinary. When we were on the ship in Antarctica, which was in the kind of middle 2 weeks of January, the crew and most of the passengers were very much aware that that Endurance expedition search was happening, that they were just beginning it around that time. We were on the other side of the Antarctic Peninsula from the Weddell Sea, which is where the ship was. And the Weddell Sea is one of the most inaccessible places for a ship to go because the geography produces a particularly thick ice sheet, but it also has a very flat seafloor. So searching for things on that seafloor offers more chance of success than it might in some other places. And because Antarctica has relatively fewer organisms, minute marine organisms that would eat things like shipwood, they were optimistic that the ship would be in good condition if it were found. Shackleton and his men knew where the ship went down. And so the search mission knew that it would have moved and have drifted with the ice, but that it wouldn't have necessarily gone 1,000 miles off course. So the feeling on the ship at the time among the sailors was a lot of confidence that they would find the Endurance, which seemed remarkable to me, given how many, you know, nearly 200 years it took to find John Franklin's lost Arctic ship, Erebus and Terror.
At the North Pole.
Exactly, in the Arctic, in the North, which was its own remarkable story of loss and discovery. But unlike the Arctic ships, which for generations the Inuit had tried to say or tried to communicate or tried not to communicate, that they knew exactly where the ships were.
Yeah.
You know, the Antarctica does not have an indigenous human presence, and so there was nobody there to point out the ship.
No, and if you're not going to believe the natives anyway, I suppose, which happened
precisely
with the Franklin crew. So
until they finally did.
Yeah, so wonderful. I wanted to ask, we actually have film footage taken by Shackleton's crew of the Endurance breaking up in that voyage in which they lost the ship but were later rescued. He did live through that ordeal, just barely perhaps, but he did live through it. But wonderful footage. I just stumbled across it on the internet because of the find. And then there were these period movies, really. Looked like D.W. Griffith did the footage almost there of the voyage. So just wonderful images, not only of a ship falling apart and their passages where you see the masts falling down. They actually caught that, but also of the landscape, which is really frightening just to see in an old movie like that, to talk about inhospitable environment.
Well, Ernest Shackleton gets credited, and rightly so, for his extraordinary leadership in keeping all of the men of the Endurance alive. But what to me is even more remarkable from an expeditionary history standpoint is his incredible media savvy in bringing on the expedition Frank Hurley, who's an extraordinary photographer and filmmaker, and who took the incredible images that we have of the Endurance were all taken by Hurley. And when they were abandoning the ship, knowing that it would sink, even as they're killing their pet cat because they can't bring the cat along with them, Hurley is diving into the wreck to retrieve photographic plates, which are huge and heavy. And so these are valued just as strongly as food and fuel in their rescue mission. So Shackleton knew that having images of this expedition, it's the disaster of the loss of the ship that could have turned into the wider tragedy of the loss of the lives of the sailors, which didn't happen, but that form of documentation, recognizing that this is a media event, was to me something that is even more remarkable about Shackleton. And it's consistent with what I write about in the book, which is Shackleton's interest in creating Antarctic newspapers and printing an Antarctic book on his previous command with the Nimrod expedition.
Yeah.
He was deeply aware of the power of text and images to communicate the otherworldliness of polar exploration. But we'll see. One of the amazing things that's happened in the last week with the news breaking of the ship is that my email's been lighting up with messages from fellow polar scholars and enthusiasts. And many of us are thinking, what is the library going to look like in the ship? Because again, the cold preserves things like paper in a way that they would not have been preserved in different kinds of seas. So we'll see. We'll see what kind of documents might emerge.
There are all sorts of things about this region of the world that have this strangeness about them. And part of it is the inhospitableness of the environment. And I don't think we think of that very often. I mean, we think of the Earth as a, you know, a home for all of us, but most of us don't often think about the great swaths of land and sea that comprise the Earth's polar regions any more than we think about the surface of the moon, maybe. But that world, although it is changing dramatically now with climate change, is still very much there and just as inhospitable. And I wonder if you can give us an idea of the strangeness of these regions or what you call their outlandishness.
Yeah, I've had the privilege in my life of traveling a lot and traveling to a lot of places that have felt relatively underdeveloped and relatively underpopulated and relatively remote. But what I didn't fully grasp before going to the Arctic on an expedition in 2019 and Antarctica last month, 2 months ago now, is the total absence of human infrastructure in most parts of those regions. Even in other places that I have been, you'll see a telephone or electric wire, or you'll see a road. In some way, there are the marks of human infrastructure. And for most of the time that I spent in the polar regions, that total absence of human infrastructure was remarkable and not something I had accounted for in my anticipation.
That's interesting because in the Arctic, the Inuit do live there, but they mm-hmm. leave a light footprint, I suppose, don't they?
Part of it is that the population density is quite low mm-hmm. in the Arctic and the geographical range is huge. But given conditions, for example, the towns in Nunavut and the Northwest Territories and Yukon, to speak of the Canadian Arctic as well as Northern Alaska, many of those towns are accessible only by airplane or by ship or by ice roads in the winter. So the easy transit that most people in much of North America or in Northern Europe anticipate to connect people functions very differently in the Arctic. So the visibility of the kind of support structures that transportation normally needs is just not there, or when it emerges is often facilitated by, for example, oil and gas companies or other colonial forms of resource extraction or connecting people for reasons other than just habitation. And so it has its own damaging effects beyond just the geophysical ones.
Yeah, I suppose that has to be a worry now that the ice sheets are melting both in the North and South Poles, that oil companies will be wanting to go in there and start drilling if they can get...
Without question. And that was really visible in the Arctic, that a lot of where, you know, poverty levels are higher than they are in some other parts, for example, in Arctic Canada, and a lot of the job opportunities that are presented in some of the northern hamlets have to do with either mine cleanup for the kind of waste that's been produced or in propelling that kind of extraction, which, you know, it's frankly the case. I live in central Pennsylvania and our communities are trying to hold off the Nestle Corporation from coming in and bottling our local spring water, which would be an environmental catastrophe. But some local leaders say it would produce jobs. It's the same tension that is seen all over the globe, unfortunately.
We were talking a bit, and your book is about, to a great extent, these newspapers, the print culture of these explorations going back all the way back to the earliest expeditions of the 1840s. And I wonder if you could talk about that. These are ships that have printing presses as part of their manifest. Had to be heavy and difficult on an exploratory voyage like this. Space on the ship would be at a premium, both for the crew and also for provisions. So why would they want printing presses in a place where they have no open communication with the rest of the world at all, where basically the only people who are going to be reading these newspapers are the crew themselves? Yes.
Exactly. No, it's a paradox. It's the reason why normal nautical provisioning would never include a printing press, except occasionally in times of naval warfare when perhaps a lead ship might want to distribute news or information more broadly. And so the first printing presses find their way to the Arctic as part of the dozens of search, rescue, and recovery missions that are searching for Sir John Franklin's two missing ships, Erebus and Terror, which had set sail in 1845 with a total of 129 crew members and were not heard from after 1846-47. There was only a note left behind in a cairn saying that Franklin had died, the ships were being abandoned, and in the course of decades of searching for those ships, which again are not found until 2014 and 2016, one of the early search expeditions had brought a printing press with the idea that the location of that rescue ship would be printed on bits of colored silk or oiled colored paper so that it would stand out against the ice and also would not disintegrate like paper might, which is why the oiledness of the paper or the silk. And they would print thousands of these rescue notifications that were then sometimes sent up by fire balloon, which was an even less likely means of their transmissibility. But then with those presses aboard ship, sailors started to improvise and thought to themselves, like, let's put on a show, let's use this printer. And so started printing commemorative menus of shipboard meals, which is not uncommon in later cruising ships. In fact, becomes common, but sailors don't normally produce things like newspapers or gazettes. And so they started printing these farcical, parodic newspapers. And it became such a habit among Arctic ships that within just a few years, it became standard to have printing tools on ships for the sailors to entertain themselves in the total darkness of polar winter.
They're isolated here for long, long periods of time, aren't they? In the darkness. And it must be difficult to keep from going mad for some of them, I'm sure.
No, they do a lot of dream analysis. They're always dreaming of food and warmth, which is fascinating. And I mean, not surprising, but no, because in the far north and the far south, depending on where the sailors are, the sun doesn't rise at all for 60 to 90 days. And in order to keep their minds occupied, sailors did their traditional naval practice of putting on theatricals. They did lectures, they did slideshows with magic lanterns, all of which, again, are common forms of shipboard entertainment or just general parlor entertainment. But putting on a newspaper is weird. It's not something, again, that normally happens. In my theory about this and what I argue in the book is that because newspapers are designed to be periodic, usually diurnal, daily. And in a time when the sun doesn't rise or set for weeks, if not months at a time, newspapers became a way to mark time or at least to call attention to how weird a time was functioning in those periods. That they didn't have the normal markers of time.
Sort of like prisoners carving the days, on the cell block wall a bit.
Exactly.
Interesting. Interestingly, in this case, we have newspapers, but there can't be any news or not a whole hell of a lot of news, that they don't actually just sort of make up or invent because they have no connection with the outer world. They don't know what's going out there. So the news would all be internal. And so I wondered, does this cause them to perceive their own environment in a more minute way at all? Do they start looking around to say, what can I say about so-and-so today?
That certainly happens. And the classic account of what newspapers do for community comes from Benedict Anderson in Imagined Communities, where he describes how newspapers allow people who are in a dispersed geographic region to feel like they're all part of the same country or land or broader union or federation of people. But on ships, it's weird because nobody's far flung. They're all within, 100 feet of you. The ship constitutes the entire world. And so the newspaper in this way also then serves a different kind of community function. So there's a lot of inside jokes and inside references, only some of which I can decode in my own knowledge of the expedition. But that turning inward then can become petty. It can mock fellow members for how they smell or how they conduct themselves. So much of the content of these papers is funny. There is a lot of joking. And it almost never covers the actual substance of the expedition. That's left for the many other writings that the sailors are producing. But these newspapers give you a sense of the inner life of the expedition. They're kind of like the social media expeditions. From the beginning and working on this project, I would describe it to people and they would all say, oh, that's just like Facebook or that's just like Twitter. And it's true. It's true.
Really interesting. One question is, does this information ever get out into the real world outside of the ship eventually? I mean, are the newspapers ever kept and published later?
In a few cases, they are for expeditions that were either particularly well known or had achieved particular renown or notoriety. So the South Polar Times, which is the first newspaper published in Antarctica, is later available in a facsimile limited edition because this is Robert Falcon Scott's first command, the legendary Antarctic explorer who dies later on the ice after his failed attempt to be the first to reach the South Pole when he's beaten to the pole by Roald Amundsen. So that's his shipboard publications end up recirculating. William Edward Parry's newspaper, the North Georgia Gazette, is published as part of his own voyage narrative. This was a particularly successful expedition that reached farthest north and west that stood for a very long time. But for the most part, no, they don't recirculate. They're meant to be kept as souvenirs or mementos that are passed along to family members. And so, again, show up in archives only if that particular sailor's papers make it to the archive. They are not part of the public record of expeditions for the most part. And in fact, if you read for all of the hundreds of popular histories that are still published monthly about historical polar expeditions, when it comes to thinking of how they got through the winters, there'll be a paragraph, maybe a page that will say, and they did some theatricals, they published a newspaper, they read a lot of books.
So do they ever negotiate class, say, or things that would provide tension in the real world, difference between the officers and the enlisted men, although this isn't a military voyage necessarily, or differences, say, between people who are literate and aren't literate, professionals? There must have been people who knew about how to manage a printing press on board.
Sure, sure. What's amazing about the different hierarchies is that in the normal nautical world, shipboard hierarchies are really strict, and especially within naval systems, but even within merchant and other forms of shipboard life, those hierarchies are pretty strong. On polar expeditions, polar voyages tend to be much smaller in their crew for the most part than some of those other voyages. And because of the unusual way that time works in the regions and because of the other environmental conditions, those crews end up, if not so much flouting the hierarchies, they end up more intimate in their space and their operation than some other ship. That doesn't mean that there isn't a pretty strict difference between officers and men who would be the common seamen. Yeah. There certainly are. But the hierarchies that are visible in some of the early Arctic newspapers start to disappear as everyone is contributing in some way or another to shipboard papers or to their production. And some of the sailors had worked as jobbers, had done some job printing, or had some experience with presses, or had some mechanical facility and picked it up. So those distinctions, which again are never gone, I mean, they're important, but they are less absolute in polar ships than they might be in other nautical contexts.
And I get the sense from your book that there's pressure to produce here because the audience has the same number of people in it as the as the people you have to draw on to produce, and you need writers apart from people who can sort type, which I've done in the past. That's very time consuming, putting the type back in the type case, I can tell you. So you've got 30 people possibly on a ship reading the newspaper, and then you've got 30 people on the ship possibly producing the newspaper, so you can get it out, you know, every so often. Maybe daily would have been optimistic, but...
No, most of these papers are not daily. They try to be weekly in many cases, although because time functions differently, the timeline starts to attenuate. So something might be published every 7 days for the first couple of issues, and then it might be 12 days or longer. And part of that also has to do with coming up with material. A lot of the jokes are about having nothing to say and nothing to write. contributions, which is...
There is no news.
Exactly.
That is funny.
Contributions to many of the papers were supposedly anonymous or pseudonymous, although I'm sure that everyone knew who wrote everything. You know, they had drop boxes. Some people tried to disguise their handwriting, but those are all open secrets.
Yeah. Interesting. So, you know, you mentioned time. Of all the displacements affected by the extremities of the poles, I find the displacement of our normal measures of time and cycles of earthly temporality among the most uncanny. You know, apart from the lack of time zones, which are non-existent at the poles themselves, and the displacement of the diurnal cycle of the hours of the day and of the seasons of the year, the polar regions seem not to register time in any way we're used to in the temperate world. And this seems to enhance, in a way, our wanting to think of these regions as timeless archives. And you mentioned also, of course, there's the climate. Things don't disintegrate in these regions. So geologic and meteorological archives of deep time, of course, are embedded here in the earth itself and the ice, but also they seem to preserve whatever is left there, like the cairn you said you came across it, you know, in the Antarctic, or the huts left by Scott and Shackleton at Cape Evans and Cape Royds, which you describe as de facto museums and libraries. So, so there's something strange about the way these worlds exist in measures that we understand living in the real world in time, you know, with the calendar and with the clock.
It's true. And I recently read read a book called Timelines that talks mm-hmm. about timefulness, that, and it's a book about geological deep time and how to conceive of it. And the coinage of timefulness is a way to talk about, certainly geologic time is not just timeless. When we talk about something as being timeless, that in can be a useful rubric for understanding duration, but what it also does is it kind of absolves humans from the responsibility of being aware just of how those timescales are working. Mm-hmm. And so I like that notion very much, because so much of the language around climate right now is about acceleration, right? Mm-hmm. We're in the great acceleration in terms of anthropogenic climate change. Mm-hmm. The melting of polar ice sheets is accelerating. Climate catastrophe is accelerating. And part of what I have learned from reading Indigenous writers and Indigenous scholars and theorists is that what seems to be a kind of accelerating emergency for much of the white Western world is just part of a continuum for Indigenous people for all of modernity, for 500, 1,000 years. So that sense of what seems to be out of time or timeless or an accelerating time is a wholly constructed, or if not fully constructed, is a largely culturally constructed, as you know, any good humanist will tell you about most concepts, but especially important in thinking about climate emergency, that what seems to be a climate emergency to my neighbors in central Pennsylvania has been a climate emergency throughout the history of colonialism for Inuit and Yupik and Inuvialuit and other northern people.
Absolutely fascinating. So there are people here, and part of what you call the sublime blankness about these regions that draws us toward metaphors of inscription and printing sort of generally in them, you know, they're blank sheets of paper, the poles and the Arctic regions, is that they occlude the fact that there are people and life forms here, plants and animals, and then we do tend to ignore them. And the explorers themselves tended to ignore these people, as you mentioned, with the polar expeditions. When all these expeditions were being launched to look for Franklin, nobody was listening to the Inuit who were telling them exactly what happened.
Well, yes, the sublime blankness is the attitude that Romantic writers had initially towards the Arctic region. Mm-hmm. And that is a trope that has been taken up for 200 years subsequently. Mm. And it's that idea of the Arctic as blank rhymes completely with the history of colonialism that saw the Americas as what many early European colonists called a howling wilderness. Uh-huh. It was not empty. It was not howling in its blankness. And the idea of the Arctic as sublimely blank was also a kind of fiction of that form of Western attention, which is not to say, of course, that there were not geographical and climate challenges to travel in the regions and to life in the regions. The indigenous life has persisted in the northern regions for thousands of years, but obviously it's not an easy form of subsistence. And the kinds of climate adaptability that were modeled always by Inuit in particular, and thinking of Arctic exploration coming from a British, Norwegian, American perspective, was heeded to varying and often belated degrees by a lot of those so-called explorers who didn't adapt to Inuit life ways, which would include eating raw seal as a way to not get scurvy and to keep your energy up, using fur instead of wool or cotton, using dogs for travel rather than man hauling sleds. I mean, there's a whole variety of cultural practices that white Westerners were very slow to adopt.
Yeah, well, the story of the horses was particularly sad, wasn't it? In the Antarctic expeditions, there was an attempt to use horses to pull sledges.
Yeah, these poor ponies. And they brought the motor cars to Antarctica initially. You know, these are all obviously failed attempts to impose on one region what has worked in other regions.
And then space is peculiar in these regions as well as time, isn't it? I read an account of an American nuclear submarine, I think in the 50s or the 60s, surfacing at the North Pole. Somehow, I don't know how they got through the ice, but somehow they surfaced right near the North Pole. The crew got out and they went to the pole and they played a baseball game at the North Pole with North Pole itself as the pitcher's mound. so that they could say that every time someone hit a home run, they could circumnavigate the globe by doing so. And also they could hit the ball to the four corners of the earth whenever they hit the ball. But it is, space is just as peculiarly measured here as time, isn't it? So,
and, you know, the poles are in some ways like latitude and longitude. There are certain kinds of fiction and shorthands for inscription and placemaking. Although obviously the poles are the orientation of the Earth's spin. So it does turn in some ways the poles into a kind of planetary register more broadly. But also that fiction is a really powerful and persuasive one. A Swedish sailor that I met on the Arctic expedition I did with the Northwest Passage Project told me that he had baptized his daughter with water from ice that he had brought from the North Pole, that he was distilling whiskey from ice that he had brought from the South Pole, which are incredibly powerful images to imagine in his storytelling here. But the life force that polar ice visited him and his family was really profound. And it was really moving to hear that story that he had given his infant daughter a stuffed animal that he had placed on the pole. That there's a talismanic form of attachment there too.
So we talked about the printing presses and you mentioned the balloons. What about the cairns and the messages that were left in cairns? Because that seems to me just as peculiar as sending balloons out with messages on them and letting the winds disperse them on the hope that someone will actually see the messages and know what to do with them. So we have these same kinds of messages being left in the middle of nowhere under these rock piles.
Yeah, so throughout the history of polar travel and general travel in regions that have fewer geographic markers, travelers would pile up stones on promontories, on cliff edges, in places where they'd be widely visible, often with a flag stuck into it to help aid in the visibility. And for these North American and British and Scandinavian expeditions, those cairns would be used to leave messages, but also to store food or supplies. They became kind of supply depots. But they quickly discovered that polar bears don't like things that stick up in the landscape. I've heard this from multiple travelers. Uh-huh. And if you watch any Arctic documentary, for example, you'll see polar bears come and try to paw at flags or markers that are left. They don't like things that are stuck up, I've been told. So those cairns were often destroyed by polar bears. It was one issue. But what was fascinating to me, and what I didn't realize until working on this book, is that the Inukshuk, that are stone figures or not so much cairns, but could have the appearance of human-made stone formations that are erected by Inuit and other Northern Indigenous people, would be viewed by British or American expedition members as cairns to be knocked down to look for hidden messages. Whereas what the Inukshuk were themselves were the message, the rock formations were the signal that could say either this is a place to fish or this is a place to turn or indicating the direction that a trail might go. And so the difference between whether the medium was the message, another one of those kind of cultural distinctions. And, you know, those cairns, as I write in the book, most will probably survive today. In the 1960s, 100 years after some of these messages were erected, they were newly found or newly encountered by Canadian oil and gas companies in scouting territory. I think this is going to continue to happen. And that's the story of the finding of the Endurance as well, that as technology allows increasing access to the region, in large part enabled by climate change that is allowing more human access. The only kind of upside to me of that kind of climate change is that things are emerging from the ice. They remain at play. They remain in circulation.
In some cases, though, aren't there laws requiring you to put things back, as with the huts that were discovered in the Antarctic from the Scott and Shackleton expeditions?
Yes. And the Endurance is not going to be raised from the seafloor. It will remain there. It's not to be touched. No one is ever supposed to remove those materials or those artifacts from the space where they exist, but they can be documented and they can be made accessible digitally in some cases. But much like the injunctions against removing objects from national park sites, for example, are often ignored by visitors, thinking of what it means to understand the placedness of whether it's these rock messages or the expeditionary huts left behind, which by Antarctic treaty either have to be preserved or removed. You can't dispose of trash in Antarctica. You either have to preserve it or remove it.
That's good news.
Yes, exactly.
So everything in this environment, as you take us into it, seems to reflect on or fold back on itself in strange ways, it seems to me. You know, the quest of several decades of exploratory missions in the 19th century to discover the fate and even possibly rescue one of the earliest exploratory expeditions in the Arctic, John Franklin's, has this air about it. Explorers urgently striking out to find lost explorers. There's necessarily something self-reflexive about this, I think. And the recent quest, in a way, of the remains of the Endurance is this kind of a thing, I think. And of course, the Franklin narrative absolutely saturated traditional media, both high media and the newspapers throughout the world in the 19th century. So, you know, I wonder about this kind of self-reflexiveness. Is there something about the Arctic that causes us to do this kind of thing? I mean, do you ever think about it yourself, that there's something strange about this? Franklin, especially the story. I can't get my mind around it quite. You have people going out risking their lives, not to bring somebody back necessarily from the moon, although I suppose you could think of it like that, but just on the slight chance, though, you might find somebody out there to bring back.
Well, the way I approach the reflexivity question, and you're absolutely right, there is something self-reflexive here. And no matter how terrible the conditions are and the fact that most expeditions fail, there is a drive to return that so many of the explorers document on the most minor possible level. I've been to the Antarctic once and the Arctic once or twice, and all I want to do is go back. So, which is, again, not... it's not comparable in its exposure, but
I just read Shackleton said exactly the same thing. He didn't want to be anywhere else but exploring these regions.
I can't wait to go back. But the reflexivity to me that's fascinating and chilling, really, is that the first Arctic expeditions by Europeans began in early modernity in like the 1500s as a way of creating new trade routes, right? Looking for the Northwest Passage, trying to establish more global trade routes and access to resources. And so that's the beginning of modernity that leads to the industrialization in the 18th and 19th centuries that helps to accelerate the kind of climate change that colonialism had also already produced as part of those missions in the 15th and 16th century, and that in turn create the kind of global warming that have made the Arctic and the Antarctic more accessible to humans to travel through, the open water through the Northwest Passage, the open water at the North Pole, the fact that this expedition in the Weddell Sea could find the Endurance because the ice is not as thick as it used to be. So what's reflexive to me are the cycles of Arctic exploration and ultimately Antarctic are propelling the very factors that make it more possible to go to those regions, for example, for fossil fuel companies now. And that need for fossil fuel, which started in earlier periods, is what's making them more accessible and melting now. It's not a good cycle.
Vicious circle, I think, is the the word. So, so on the other hand, is there possibly a virtuous circle here, a virtuous cycle? And that, you know, as polar ice collapses and we seem to be uncontrollably hurtling toward an age of really climactic change and climate extremes that we've never seen. Is there anything we can learn from these early voyages and their attempts to account for themselves in the media of the day that might guide us in some way to some kind of redemption from apocalypse, I guess is the word? I mean, is there anything about these voyages that could point us in the right direction? I mean, this is communications technology, of course, and it's technology that tries to understand itself, what it means to be a human being in this environment. So
it's hard to be optimistic in recent days, although I appreciate the invitation to try to be optimistic. But the reality is what I have seen in these historic accounts and in the very, again, comparatively very brief glimpses I have as a kind of armchair polar traveler with the emphasis on the armchair part, is that the lesson that I take from reading about these passages is that human technology cannot overcome every possible climate challenge. Much like I don't believe that there are purely technological solutions to current climate change, there's going to be no kind of magical way that technology is going to extract humans from the hurtling course of global warming right now. I think this is something where humans will have to change their behavior rather than find a technological solution. With polar exploration too, no matter how good human technology is, you really can't get a plane into Antarctica in the winter. There is a famous story now going back a decade or two of the doctor at South Polar Station who got breast cancer and couldn't be extracted for months and had to treat herself. Places are still inaccessible. One of the ways I first got into reading about polar exploration was an obsession with reading mountaineering narratives. And after the disastrous 1996 moments on Mount Everest, when multiple climbers died, and the haunting image was of one of the expedition guides calling his wife in New Zealand on a satellite phone and naming their unborn child as he dies on the mountain. So he can have access to a satellite phone, but he can't get off the mountain. There's no technology that can get him off the mountain. So what I take away from the polar voyage narratives is the recognition that humans are wildly destructive to the environment, but are also not able to overcome or manage or completely control those environmental conditions. And so having a certain kind of humility and a recognition that the earth is in total control, I think is one way to bring about a kind of broader awareness that human behavior is not going to be able to overcome those challenges simply through human ingenuity or technological challenges, but needs to be more humble in the face of the globe.
That's the lesson, I suppose, of the notion of the sublime, isn't it? Ultimately, it is terrifying.
Absolutely. Without question.
I'd like to thank you, Hester, for visiting with us today on the Library Cafe to talk about your book, The News at the Ends of the Earth, The Print Culture Polar Exploration, published by Duke in 2019. Thanks a million for being with us and for your insights into your book, which is just wonderful.
I appreciate the kind words, and it's been delightful to be in conversation with you. And in the spirit in which we began with praising librarians like David and Deidre Stam and yourself, I will note that librarians made my book open access. So you can retrieve it and read it for free in open access form, thanks to Duke Press and the Penn State University Library.
That's wonderful.